I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Now in depth on the identity challenge facing the Republican Party. If you think owning the White House and both chambers of Congress means the GOP can leave the who are we introspection to the Democrats, you've missed the painful mess they found themselves in on health care and what may be looming on tax reform and trade and infrastructure. As The Atlantic recently wrote, these are confusing times to be a Republican. Today, a conversation about why, and I hope you'll join in. If you've been a longtime Republican or an independent or a Democrat who crossed over to vote for President Trump, can you say that you understand where the party stands and stands today and what it stands for today? And even with the political trifecta in Washington, does the Republican Party need reform? So if you have an understanding about what the party stands for today, or you're confused, I'd love to hear from you this morning. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at Carrie NPR. Talk to me about even having both chambers of Congress and the White House. Does the Republican Party need to reform? On Twitter, at Carrie NPR, by phone, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Our guest today, McKay Coppins, is a journalist, and his article for The Atlantic is titled The Republican Identity Crisis. It informed our conversation today. McKay, welcome. It's really good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Joseph Usinski is with us. He's a professor of political science at the University of Miami and co-author of American Conspiracy Theories. And he's with us today in Coral Gables. And Joe, welcome back to the show. Good to talk to you again.
Great to be with you again.
You know, McKay, this is interesting because before the election, when it looked like Trump was going to lose, there was a lot of speculation about how the GOP had to broaden its appeal and who it was going to be and reach out to constituencies that it typically didn't. But now, you know, Trump has apparently made that introspection even more necessary. Who knew that was going to happen? What's your take on that?
Yeah, you wouldn't have expected that, right? I mean, usually when a party controls the White House and both chambers of Congress, they kind of just plow forward with their agenda. Instead, I think the fact that they have power, the Republican Party has this power for the first time in a very long time. This is a very unusual moment in the history of the Republican Party. It's almost made that debate about what Republicanism means and what it stands for more relevant and more urgent, because they're kind of all wondering, what do we do with this power? And the fact that Republicans can have so much power in Washington, I think, has created this illusion that there's this unified partisan agenda that they're all ready to cram through. The reality is there are a lot of factions in the party, and that goes for politicians and office holders, elected officials. It also goes for just rank and file Republican voters, and that's one of the things that my piece focused on. What kind of sparked the idea for this was that I had talked to two prominent Republicans recently who told me that they're having a hard time identifying where they fall on this on the ideological spectrum now, because Donald Trump's very unique brand of kind of nationalist populism has sort of upended the traditional ways that we think about the different kinds of conservatives and Republicans. And so I put the question to Twitter, and I asked Republicans to write to me, and I was kind of swamped with responses. And all of them were sort of saying, you know, the old kind of moderate to conservative spectrum that existed in the Republican Party doesn't feel like the really relevant way anymore to map the ideological diversity in the party.
Let me put that to Joe, because what McKay wrote in his piece, Joe, about, you know, asking people on Twitter to weigh in, he wrote, but virtually everyone who wrote to me shared a common complaint. The traditional left-right spectrum used to describe and categorize Republicans has become obsolete in the age of Trump. The question now is what to replace it with. First, do you agree with the premise of that?
I'm not sure that conservatism or liberalism ever really meant anything. And if you poll people out in the public, what you find is that they're not really that ideological. And political scientists have known this for, you know, almost 80 years now, that, you know, if someone identifies as a liberal or conservative or a Republican or a Democrat, and you ask them, well, where do you stand on issues? at most they'll be able to match, you know, three or four issues to where the party stands. So most people aren't really in lockstep with, you know, with the two parties. And even more than that, what we tend to find is that when a party says A, the people who say they belong to the party will say A. But when the party changes its mind and says B, then people will say the same thing.
Okay, here, Joe, here's what I don't understand about that, though. If you find in most states, you will still, and districts, you will still find strong party identification when you look at voting patterns. So how is it?
That's very different than saying that identification leads to particular issues.
Talk to me about the difference there and help me understand that.
So I can identify as something, but not really know exactly what it is I'm standing for. I mean, there's a really good experiment that was done during the last campaign where they asked Trump supporters, you know, where do you stand on the minimum wage? But they gave them each a different condition. So they said Trump's in favor of increasing the minimum wage. Other people were told that Trump was in favor of lowering it. Other people were told he was in favor of keeping it the same. In each condition, Republicans said whatever Trump was in favor of. So it doesn't, and you would assume, of course, that Republicans would be in favor either if they're libertarian getting rid of the minimum wage or if the Republicans certainly not raising it. But what we see happening, and this has been going on forever, is that people listen to their party elites and they support what the elites say. And it doesn't matter if it matches some underlying idea of what Republicanism or Democratism or liberalism or conservatism is. It's people are listening to their elites, and elites are doing things that are largely situational.
Okay, let me do this. I want to get a caller in because I think he can't hang on to Derek in Eden Prairie. Hi, Derek.
Hi.
Tell me how you're thinking about, you say you're a moderate Republican, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm in the middle, of the road. I don't believe everything the Republican Party has to say, but I don't, you know, but I'm not I'm not a Democrat either. So, and, you know, that's kind of where I'm at.
What do you think about how the party responds to your brand of Republicanism?
Well, that's the big question. I don't know where my party stands anymore. I sort of feel abandoned to a certain extent. I don't feel like the things they're voting on are good things, and they don't really represent my beliefs anymore. That's one of my issues, and the big one for me was the whole healthcare. You know, we've been told for 6 years that, you know, we have a better healthcare plan, and then when they put forward wasn't very good, and I sort of feel like I was sold a bill of goods, and it makes me wonder how much of this is going on.
McKay, how reflective of that is it from the people that you've been talking to?
Yeah, that sentiment that the caller just expressed was very common among the Republicans I heard from. One of the people who wrote to me was named Alicia. She was a conservative Christian from Dallas, Texas. And she said, I honestly feel like a part of my identity was stolen by this election. And she went on and to describe kind of the feeling of seeing people who she had long trusted, from conservative pundits to religious leaders to her neighbors, kind of rally around Donald Trump, who she found to be a very, I think, unpleasant and somewhat repulsive figure. That I think a lot of people described that feeling. And that is, I think, you know, that does go to a certain kind of almost tribal identity politics, right? So it's absolutely true that a lot of people just vote party line, and it's not based on ideology or philosophy or necessarily issues completely. It's based on how they identify. But I think a lot of people, what's made this election and the rise of Donald Trump so jarring is that it is about their identity, and they feel like this thing that they've identified with for so long has suddenly changed its meaning, and they're trying to figure out what that means for themselves.
What do you make of that, Joe?
I have to wonder if the previous caller voted for Trump, or if some of the people that your other guest is mentioning from Twitter voted for Trump. I mean, it was clear to anyone who was looking at this during the primaries that Trump was not a traditional Republican in any sense. He was a Republican. He was, you know, the perfect definition of rhino. He was a Republican in name only. I think he had been a Democrat all his life. He spoke like a New Dealer. He was largely, you know, we could categorize him as a populist, but every issue that he pushed was either he had a very nebulous position on it, or he gave, you know, Democratic talking points. In many ways, he was just the opposite side of the Bernie Sanders coin.
I mean, here's what's confusing, Joe, about Trump. He seems kind of post-ideological or non-ideological in a lot of ways, but then in some ways, he's quite ideological. I mean, the Supreme Court nominee who's about to become a member of the court today was a very ideological choice. But in a lot of his other views, he seems beyond that or apart from that or uninterested in that.
It's hard to know what goes on in Trump's mind, but if you look at his issue positions, I mean, you would probably say that he's something of a New Deal Democrat who doesn't like regulation, but makes up for it by wanting to spend even more.
McKay, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, so I think that you mentioned the judge. I think that Gorsuch, some of the things that Donald Trump is doing may not necessarily be manifestations of his personal belief system and ideology. And I actually, you know, I've in the past spent some time with Donald Trump interviewing him. I'm not sure actually that he spends a lot of time in general thinking about ideology. But beyond that, I think that some of the things he's doing are just matters of, you know, the result of political pressure put on him by traditional Republican elites who he's now working with, who are offering him support in Washington. He made a promise during the campaign to appoint a very conservative Supreme Court justice, and I think that won over a lot of voters who didn't like his kind of, like Joe said, New Deal populism, but did want a conservative justice on the Supreme Court. But I think that, you know, beyond that, I don't know that it's right to say that he is not making ideological choices or that he doesn't have strong ideology. I just think that the ideological underpinnings of Trumpism are not the same as kind of conservative Republicanism. It's a different brand of Republicanism, and a big question now that we're all trying to figure out, and certainly a lot of people in the party are trying to figure out, is this going to spread over, you know, the next 4 years, 10 years, 20 years, the way that Barry Goldwater conservatism spread throughout the Republican Party over the last half century?
This is a conversation, if you've just happened to get in on it, that was prompted by a piece that one of our guests wrote for The Atlantic about this idea of the identity of the GOP in this era of Donald Trump. And as we kind of pick this apart a little bit, we're talking about where Trump fits in here, his history as what one of our guests calls a New Deal Democrat, now leading the GOP as president, the factions that we're seeing develop within the party are really come to light as they try to pass legislation. McKay Coppins is with us. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic, and his article is called The Republican Identity Crisis. And Joe Uzinski is with us. He's a professor of political science at the University of Miami. And I'm asking you, longtime Republican, independent, Democrat, moderate Republican, you crossed over maybe to vote for Trump as a Democrat. Can you say you understand what the party stands for today? Do you have clarity around that? And even with, as I've been putting this, the political trifecta in Washington, does the Republican Party need reform? 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. On Twitter, Sarah says, I'm a Republican, but the party doesn't have my values. I don't agree with their health policy or the SCOTUS strategy, Supreme Court strategy. Didn't vote for Trump. I'm a woman without a party. And to the phones to Jose in Minneapolis. Hi, Jose. How are you thinking about this?
Hi. How are you?
Doing well. Thanks for calling.
I was a Bernie Sanders supporter at one point.
Uh-huh.
And then I was pushed to jump into the Trump idea.
Uh-huh.
Then the Republican Party promised me to keep this guy in check and to watch up after what he does. They also promised me that they were going to try to help him to be a better president, that they were going to teach him how to be a president, and everything was going to be okay because the Republican Party was going to stand up for what is okay. And I mean, after a while, I just can see that nobody can talk to this guy. Nobody can change his mind. Nobody can, like they promised me, to keep him accountable for whatever he does. And it pretty much threw away my vote because I wanted to be leaving the Republican side, not because of Trump. Okay, I voted for Trump because the Republican Party promised me that they were going to do the right thing.
Okay. So Joe McKay, one of those elusive Bernie Sanders to Donald Trump voters that were also intrigued about. McKay, what do you make of what he said?
Yeah, well, I mean, he's not wrong to feel maybe a little betrayed by Republican elites. I think there were a lot of Republican leaders who made the case during the campaign. In fact, I know this was a talking point that was circulated in Washington, and you heard it time and time again during the election, that, you know, Donald Trump is not a politician. He doesn't have a lot of experience. But, you know, if you're somebody who is a little bit wary of voting for him, don't worry. We'll make sure he's surrounded. He's getting by the right advisors. He's going to bring his unique sensibility into Washington. But we're going to make sure that we can harness his message and actually turn it into practical policy victories. And he'll become more presidential. Look, I can't tell you. I covered the Trump campaign. I can't tell you how many voters I talked to at these Trump rallies who would say, yeah, look, I don't really love how he tweets all the time. I don't love how he picks fights with cable news hosts or says, you know, certain kinds of lewd things. But I think that the weight of the office will really turn him into a more presidential figure. Now, look, I think people who were opposed to Donald Trump hear that and want to tear their hair out because they feel like, you know, he was very open and, you know, pretty candid about who he was during the election. But you know, if you're somebody who really didn't like Hillary Clinton, or you're a longtime Republican voter, or you just liked the kind of message that Trump was bringing about shaking up Washington, I think there was a certain degree of wishful thinking that went on, and you were hoping that he really would change and that party leaders would try to rein him in. And I think so far what we've seen is what I think a lot of us reporters who covered him knew, which is that he is not somebody who can really be reined in, and he's not going to change his personality at 70 years old.
Leo says on Twitter, years from now, we'll all look back and we'll realize that Trumpism was nothing more than make it up as you go along-ism. Joe, McKay asked a good question, and I really wanted to hear you on this, which is, do we know whether whatever Trumpism is going to spread within the party, or does this seem like a limited, unique political experiment here?
The quick answer is that I think that it could spread whatever it is if Trump becomes very popular and people demand more of Trumpism. But if it doesn't, then I don't think there'll be a big demand for it. But to get back to the previous caller you had, I don't know who in the Republican Party was saying we're going to rein in the most powerful man in the world.
Yeah.
I think these were voices inside people's heads that they were using to rationalize the fact that they were going to vote for a Democrat named Trump, even though they were Republicans. I mean, during the primaries, Trump was getting, I think, almost no endorsements from the Republican establishment and Republican elites. So whatever voices,
well,
you know, we're talking about is saying, oh, don't worry, he'll be great, we'll take care of him.
Well, wait,
I don't know where those voices were coming from.
But, Joe, you know there were people like Paul Ryan who decried, you know, day to day in the campaign what was coming out about Trump, but who would never say, don't vote for him, I can't vote for him. And I think the assumption, but what he would usually add is, he's better than Hillary Clinton.
That's very different than saying, I support him and I will take care of him when he's in office and I'll rein him in.
I guess, given what Jose said to us, I thought, well, the assumption was, we can manage him. It's better to have a Republican in the White House any day under our management than it is Hillary Clinton. And maybe maybe you're right. You're making leaps of logic there to justify the fact that you're going to vote for Trump.
Partisan identification is incredibly strong. And in this case, it's so strong that people voted for a New Deal Democrat. And they rationalized it in their minds in all sorts of different ways. And what Jose is doing is trying to blame Republican elites for what he heard in his own mind.
Mm-hmm. Call here from Don in Lakeville. Hi, Don. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, Carrie. Thank you. I had several comments to your screener, but I think that the one that he wants me to that he focused on was the fact that I was a Trump voter. I was a Rubio supporter. That's who I voted for in our primary, and I never liked Trump, but I also don't necessarily like the very conservative wing of the Republican Party. I think that the House Freedom Caucus needs to be reined in, and I think that Trump might have an opportunity to do that. I would like to see, I'm a moderate Republican, I would like to see my party step back from the brink where they are with conservatism. And Trump's probably our best chance to do that.
Don, I appreciate the call. Jessica says, as a fiscal conservative and a woman, Trump goes against everything I believe, couldn't vote for him. To the phones to John listening in Seattle, Washington. Hi, John. How are you thinking about this?
Yeah, I just think it maybe, you know, as I was going into the election, as a, I guess I would consider myself a centrist, you know, voting for Hillary Clinton because I didn't like Trump. But I'm from Northwest Iowa, Steve King's district.
Yep.
And when I go home and talk to people there, they just like Trump because he represents someone that's going to sort of stick it to the government.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, here in Seattle, Washington, or where I live in Minneapolis full time, you run into a lot more people that sort of say, hey, the government serves a purpose. We don't need to shove it out. I think really what we're seeing with the Republican Party is maybe I'd like to think the death of traditional conservatism, as I've known it since the early 1980s. But certainly the rise of the Tea Party is sort of taking on the mantle. And of course, they're going to love someone like Trump who they can sort of bandy about or manipulate. I'd like to think the Democratic Party is going to sort of run on what Henry Wallace was getting at in the 40s. We've already taken care of a lot of the social issues there, you know, with women's rights and certainly civil rights. We're not there yet. But I think the Democratic Party is going to be able to use the friction in the Republican Party to really stand up and say, hey, we've got great ideas and more people are educated and more people are interested in our ideas than they are in necessarily just blowing up the federal government and then seeing what happens, which is basically what Trump is doing. And someone like Paul Ryan, who's smart and political, is saying, hey, we might get our blown up federal government with a guy like this because people will sort of roll over and you know, take the medicine.
I think for me,
as a 35-year-old, is very exciting.
Lots to talk about there, John. Joe, first to what he said about what this means for the Democrats taking advantage of the friction that's going on within the GOP.
Well, it's sort of an interesting conversation we're having about who has an advantage right now. I mean, we're talking about, does the Republican Party need reform? And it sort of seems like, I mean, if you just step back and look, they have control of the House, the Senate, the White House, and now the Supreme Court. It seems like they must be doing something right. And so I have to wonder, I mean, how big of an advantage do Democrats have just because Trump is going to make missteps? I don't know how big that is. So,
McKay?
Yeah, well, I mean, look, I think that it's certainly true. I think we said at the top of this conversation that Republicans have much more power than they have in a long time. But I think that to a certain extent, the power has created an illusion that that this is, you know, that this is one party controlling government. It might be one party controlling government, but it's not necessarily one set of ideas. The caller said something interesting, and I think that one of the things I try to get at in my piece is I asked all these Republicans who wrote into me what they see as the biggest divisions in the party right now. And not all of them were ideological. But some of them were. And one of the big things that I heard from people was that you could map the diversity within the Republican Party today between anti-establishment, from anti-establishment to establishment. So on one end of the spectrum would be people who respect existing political institutions, believe in conforming to their norms and using the system to advance their agenda. On the other end of the spectrum are people who believe the establishment is so hopelessly ineffectual or corrupt or whatever that it needs to be circumvented whenever possible. And you know, that could be why you saw a lot of people who rallied around the Tea Party in 2010 mm-hmm. as, you know, anti-establishment outsiders who were for extremely limited government and budget cuts and tax cuts, who are now rallying around Donald Trump, who wants to spend $1 trillion on infrastructure. It's not because they really care that much about limited government. What they care about is taking on the political establishment.
Okay, so this is, Joe, I wanted to ask you about this, and I'm glad McKay brought up the Tea Party, because I wonder what the effect the Freedom Caucus is going to have on the way Republicans try to govern. And if we see some, you know, signals, if we look back to history, to what the Tea Party did to the Republican Party.
Well, the Tea Party really helped the Republican Party 7 years ago. I don't know what value they bring now as a separate or organization, right? I don't know what the Freedom Caucus really does for the Republican Party, except give organization to a particular wing. But, I mean, the same exact thing that McKay just said could be said about the Democratic Party. I mean, you have some Republicans who want to get rid of things like the Department of Education and massively shrink the size of the federal bureaucracy. On the other side, you have the Bernie wing of the Democratic Party who don't respect institutions, not because they want to blow them up, but because they want to inflate them and make them huge and have government pay for pretty much everything. And if you look at, you know, the rhetoric coming from the Bernie wing of the Democratic Party, it's everything is corrupt. Everything is rigged. The entire economy, the entire political system is rigged, and it all needs to be shooken up. And that's why you needed to vote for a non-Democrat named Bernie Sanders.
Joe, we have a lot of people on Twitter here pushing back against your assertion that Trump was a New Deal Democrat. I think I understood what you meant when you said that, but from Twitter here, Trump is anything but a New Deal Democrat. He shares none of their values, but nakedly exemplifies many Republican values, although his political history would suggest that he believed in a lot of the Democratic values for much of his career, I guess, in New York.
So let me tell you what that tweet is really saying. It's saying, I'm a Democrat and I hate Trump, so Trump can't be associated with anything I like,
well,
which
give me
includes
some,
FDR.
But let's use some evidence here to persuade people that don't buy this.
He wants to drop $1 trillion on infrastructure building. End of story.
McKay, is that the end of the story here?
Well, I mean, whether or not you want to use the term New Deal Democrat, I understand why people are pushing back against that. But, I mean, there are meaningful divisions between Donald Trump's brand of politics and, say, Paul Ryan's. One of the big ones is that, you know, the White House put out a budget, and while they proposed all kinds of cuts to federal programs, he campaigned on this. He said he did not want to touch entitlement programs like Social Security and Medicare, right? He didn't want to cut them. Paul Ryan and his wing of the party are adamant that those programs are not sustainable long term. They need to be reformed. They need to be overhauled. They need to be cut down.
Right.
You know, the very essence of kind of the New Deal was those big, you know, expanding the social safety net and these massive, these big federal programs. And Donald Trump, in some cases, not in every case, and he can certainly be persuaded to go one way or the other, depending on who he last talked to. But in his campaign rhetoric, he said, I don't want to cut Social Security. I want to make the country so rich that we can afford it. And that marks a radical departure from Paul Ryan conservatism.
Jay says in Minneapolis, I keep hearing people talk about populism. I'm not really sure what that means. It's hard for someone born into wealth to really understand the concerns of the regular folks who supported him. I'm going to grab a call here from Andrew in Cannon Falls. And Andrew, I only have a couple minutes, but really wanted to hear what you had to say.
Yeah, so I just, as a former Republican who's kind of feel like I've been pushed out of the Republican Party in some ways, just with, you know, the big thing for me is the rhetoric on immigrants and people that don't kind of fit that, you know, white Anglo-Saxon picture of America. That's kind of push me out of the Republican Party, because I can't identify with, you know, it seems like a pretty great dislike towards those types of folks, and that's pushed me out. And Trump, in a lot of ways, pushed me out of it just by his rhetoric throughout the campaign and what he's done initially in his first, you know, few months in office.
Thanks for the call, Andrew. McKay, just briefly, if you would. I mean, did you hear from people in your reporting of this piece who felt just as our caller did? What he does, I might be able to support. What he says really alienates me.
Yes, that was one of the most common complaints I heard, and that was true during the campaign too, right? There is a possibly a distinction between Trumpism and Trump, and Trump's kind of nationalist, populist brand of politics, I think, has potential to spread within the Republican Party. It has potential to be popular, but I think that Donald Trump himself might be the biggest hindrance to its spread because he is, you know, so easily distracted, so good at creating distractions every morning when he logs onto Twitter. And I don't know that, you know, he'll be able to advance the agenda, his agenda, the way that he wants to when he's, you know, given his personality and his style.
McKay, I look forward to reading what you write next about this, and I hope you'll come back. Really good to have you. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Joe, always a pleasure. Thank you. Good to hear
Thank
your
you.
Insight on this.
Bye.
Joe Uzinski with us, a professor of political science at the University of Miami, McKay Coppins, and you can read the piece that he wrote about the Republican identity crisis in The Atlantic, where he is a staff writer. Also want to remind you, if you get in late on any of these political conversations, what I'm talking about with Ken Rudin every Monday or politics on Monday, you can find them on my podcast. Ready whenever you have a minute to listen. Just search NPR News with Carrie Miller wherever you get your podcasts.